So thanks everybody for coming. I'll get started. I want to talk about a subject called ensemble control. These are a bunch of problems that are motivated so before I start, these are my collaborators. So some of the experimental work I'll be showing is in collaboration. And these are some of the students who have worked on these problems. The motivation is that problem of manipulating quantum systems with uncertainties or inhomogeneities in parameters governing the system dynamics is ubiquitous in spectroscopy and information processing. Typical settings include resonance offsets, inhomogeneities in the strength of the excitation field, time-dependent noise, addressing errors in context of what Chitra talked about yesterday. So there's widespread use of composite pulses and pulse shaping to correct for errors and compensate for these inhomogeneities. So coming from a controls perspective, we would actually like to understand these problems as problems in controllability of quantum dynamics. And I'll be more concrete as I go on and understand aspects of system dynamics that makes compensation possible and what kind of inhomogeneities or errors can and cannot be corrected. And I'll actually talk about various problems in different settings that address these questions. So the starting point, what motivated all this work was the setting of control of spin ensembles in magnetic resonance. So you have a collection of spin or ensemble of spins, and when put in a strong magnetic field, most of them get polarized along B naught. So that's the magnetic moment, and that is the block vector, which is being manipulated using radio frequency fields. And the transverse components of that field are being denoted here as these controls U and V, which manipulate this block vector. And a typical NMR experiment is a pulsed field that displaces this magnetization vector away from its equilibrium position. And then this magnetization persists in the static B naught field. And one, by looking at that precision through a pickup coil, one tries to look at these frequencies in your system. So one tries to get information about this delta omegas. So the problem one is interested in these settings is that the control that one applies to the sample may not be uniform. So that's the problem one calls RF inhomogeneity. The different parts of the sample might see different radio frequency fields. And secondly, there is not one frequency in the system, but the whole spectrum of those which are dispersed over a certain range. And one wants to engineer excitations that would actually take this ensemble and of systems and drive it away from its equilibrium state uniformly. So would work equally well for all values of delta omega and work well even if your control input to the system is not perfect, it's imperfect. So the problem, as we'll discuss, will actually become interesting when there is bounds on the strength of these controls. And those bounds become comparable to the spread in the frequencies that one wants to cover. So here is a typical problem, bilinear control system with drift and imperfect controls, and one wants to steer this system uniformly for all values of these natural parameters. So that's one starting point. And then the next is whether one can actually engineer excitations or input controls that would steer this ensemble as a desired function of this epsilon and delta omega. So you would want that if I think of this system as a family of systems parameterized by delta omega and epsilon, then one could want to engineer an excitation that would steer this system as a desired function of delta, omega, and epsilon. So that what one we would call as ensemble controllability, that can you steer a whole family as a desired function of these parameters. So to...
yes? You said that the problem becomes interesting if U and V are bounded, which means that if it's unbounded, the problem is trivial.
Well, if it's unbounded and there is no bounds on these, then you know this thing can be suppressed because you can do things so fast that you this won't have a role to play. Of course, it will still have a role to play if you want that your final position that you drive the system is a desired function of delta omega. But as we go on, you will see that problem becomes more challenging, and I'll talk more about that. So just to get to fix ideas, I am going to assume that there is no delta omega. So in the setting of NMR, we would assume that there is the spin ensemble. There's just one frequency, and we are sitting on resonance to that. And there is dispersion in the strength of these controls, and which lies over a certain range.
What do you mean by dispersion in the
strength of the controls? So the RF field that one applies, the coil doesn't produce a uniform field over the whole sample. So a certain area of the sample sees a larger field, other smaller field. So it's not homogeneous over the whole field. Okay, so one starts with this, and one wants to now actually show that this I can drive this system. I can drive this system and be insensitive to this parameter epsilon. And from one perspective, you see these problems, as what was talked about yesterday, can also be thought of as problems of control of infinite dimensional system, because every epsilon value parameterizes one such system, and then I have epsilon that's dispersed over in a continuum. So really, I have a continuum of systems indexed by this value epsilon, and they all are hearing the same control U and V. And this engineering of control should be done that I steer this block vector as a desired function of epsilon. So you see Lie brackets play a role here, and that's the standard construction one does to prove controllability. And actually, if I go through the main steps here, so if I actually start rotating this system by turning on this control for a certain time delta t, that's the rotation you produce. If I now switch on the other control, and then we repeat that in the opposite direction, one what finds is that one creates to leading order a displacement in the commutator of these two generators. Now this epsilon parameter, which is the dispersion parameter, actually gets raised to a square power. So you do this maneuver whereby one generates and effect a leading order generator with this power of epsilon raised to square. Now, one can take this as a building. So one says one generates the first Lie bracket between these two generators. Then one can take this commutator and build another Lie bracket or commutator by taking this displacement and nesting it like this. Then to leading order, one produces a commutator of this thing with this generator omega x. So one sees that actually this resulting leading order motion here is in direction omega y, which was actually kind of available to us a priori. However, you see this parameter epsilon that one has been raised to power epsilon cube. One can produce such motions on the block sphere and actually produce terms of the following kind. So this would be a fifth order Lie bracket. So I'm just taking these two generators and generating their various Lie brackets. Now the thing is that the power of, so omega y, these generators of motion are already available, so one might think, what's the point? But the point is that this dispersion parameter here is being raised to higher and higher powers. And now you could think of these generators, epsilon omega y, epsilon cube omega y, and these things that one produces by these complicated maneuvers as independent generators. And now imagine following a polynomial in this dispersion parameter epsilon, whose coefficients C of k can be chosen such that this polynomial f of epsilon approximates a constant function to desired level of accuracy, where this epsilon goes between a certain range 1 minus delta to 1 plus delta. So now you can see, as I take in more and more higher powers of epsilon, I can make this polynomial approximation actually better. And this also then gives one a construction whereby one can actually generate a rotation around, say, a generator omega y as a desired function of f of epsilon. In fact, any rotation of epsilon can now be broken down as an Euler angle decomposition. So one essentially has a construction which shows that because my algebra is not nilpotent and these generators, as I keep commuting them, they don't vanish, I can raise this power of epsilon to higher powers. And therefore, any arbitrary rotation as a desired function of epsilon can be built here. And this is what actually I meant by the notion of ensemble controllability, that I can engineer an input excitation such that the effect of that input excitation would be a desired rotation which is a desired function of epsilon. And more practical purposes, I can make this as a constant function of epsilon. So this would be a uniform rotation as a function of epsilon. So this is kind of a Lie algebraic proof of actually going to the heart of that this is really an infinite dimensional space parameterized by these epsilons, and one is building this sequence of polynomials which are better and better approximating any desired function of epsilon. Yes?
So there is a cut of range, so the number of steps you can take,
yes,
in the polynomial, then they give you a cut of ranges in epsilon that you could actually achieve.
How well, yes, so for with a given degree polynomial, how well can you approximate a given function?
Yeah, but there is a cutoff also in the range of epsilon.
Yes, there is a cutoff in the range of epsilon, yes. Yes, epsilon is bounded in a certain range, 1 minus delta to 1 plus delta.
So you're trying to approximate a given function, or are you trying to make f of epsilon constant?
So if I want to approximate a constant function, then I want to make f of epsilon equal to that constant value. But in general, I can try to make f of epsilon a desired function of a smooth function of epsilon. So I can try to approximate a smooth function over this range 1 minus delta to 1 plus delta by a polynomial approximation like this.
I mean, if it's a constant you want, then you know the coefficients should all be zero except the first. I must be missing something.
No.
Right?
I mean, no, if all these coefficients are zero, then that function is zero.
Oh, it's only over odd powers.
Yes, it's odd powers, but epsilon is removed. It's removed from zero to 1 minus delta to 1 plus delta. So it is odd powers here, but you know I can construct an odd function, so I can take whatever f of epsilon takes over this range, and I can reflect it on the negative side with a negative, so to make it an odd function, and then approximate it with these coefficients.
So if I understand this right, epsilon is the dispersion that you see in the sample, this f of epsilon is the function that you want to construct in your control so that
f of, exactly. So I want a rotation. I want a rotation which is a desired function of epsilon. So, you know, for example, when epsilon is 1, then f of 1 can be, say, pi by 2. So at a nominal value, I want a pi by 2 rotation. At a smaller value, I might want no excitation. So f of epsilon, if the value of the control, if the nominal f for epsilon equal to 1, I might want a full rotation. For a lower value, a smaller rotation, and so on. So f of epsilon is something that will be given to me, and I would like to engineer a control which would then take this whole family of systems parameterized by epsilon and steer them so that the net rotation would be this.
In NMR and EPR pulse design, you want that to be a constant.
Yes, but actually some of the applications that I, so I'll discuss with, I'll talk about.
How large could be data?
So this is actually, you know, a construction. You will see that it can be anything. It has any compact interval. So I'll actually,
it could be anything.
It could, delta can go from, this thing should be bounded away from zero, because if it is zero, then you are not doing anything. So then you agree we cannot do anything because I'm not applying anything. But if it is away from zero, then no matter how large value it is, you can do it.
So any information you can.
So if you just bear with me, I'll show you. Yes. So this is sitting on resonance, but this is, I think, what I want to say is that this gives you a constructive proof of that arbitrary level of accuracy is possible, and it's a construction that shows that. And that's the idea, that it is really control of infinite dimensional systems parameterized by parameter epsilon, and you can do arbitrarily well. So a design methodology is what we call this Fourier synthesis method. So it is actually really, so if you go back, one is actually trying to generate these higher powers of epsilon, because then one can actually combine them to approximate desired functions. So instead of generating polynomials in epsilon, I'll now try to actually generate trigonometric functions in epsilon. So imagine doing a rotation here around x-axis for a certain time I write as k pi, and then a rotation around y-axis for a small flip angle beta k over 2, and then a rotation around x-axis. And this, by Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff, if you actually look at this, that's the net rotation one produces. So rotation around x, y, x. And that's one produces. And then if just one swaps the phase of these two here, then one produces another rotation in which all that happens is that this plus sign here gets swapped to a negative sign here. So then if I look at the product of this U1 and U2, then for small flip angles beta k, that is the leading order term. And one sees that one actually takes this cosine k and puts it in the exponent. So you have here an epsilon, this dispersion parameter, that was already floating around. And with this construction, one gets a cosine which has all nonlinear powers of epsilon up there in the exponent. Now, if one takes product of such things with different values of k's, then one synthesizes here in the exponent a Fourier series. So I take product of such thing, and one gets a Fourier series here, whose coefficients beta k actually are something which are a part of a pulse design. So one can choose these beta k's now, such that I approximate the function 1 over epsilon, or theta over epsilon, over a given range of dispersion of epsilon, so that this product here will cancel this epsilon term here, and one will actually end up with an exponent of a constant rotation times this generator omega y. So that would be actually a building block of such a such sequence of rotations, rotations around x, y, minus x, y, and so on. And a concatenation of these would then, can be called as a composite pulse sequence. But the idea is that one can compute the parameters of that pulse sequence by actually computing a Fourier series. So one can then get these coefficients beta k analytically, and one can plug them in there and actually get this. So this, when actually applied, here is actually a demonstration of this, that I apply it to a sample in which my epsilon values go from nominal to 1/10 of its value. So as you see that if I don't do anything, instead of applying a full pi by 2 pulse, one is actually applying a smaller and smaller values, and therefore one actually gets nothing in the end. But actually by compensating, one actually can have a uniform excitation over a full, an order of magnitude in the value of epsilon.
I mean, if you don't mind, could you go back one more slide? Okay, I think I got this part. How about we go back again to the next one? I didn't understand the connection between this and that.
Connection between this and this?
Yes.
So here, epsilon is varying from a nominal value 1 to 1/10 of its value. So if I go back here, epsilon has a nominal value 1, I reduce the value of epsilon to 1/10 of its value. So if I look at the Bloch sphere, then what will happen is that if I was to give a pi by 2 pulse, I will come down, and whatever power or amplitude I have applied for a given time t, I will come down here for that. If I reduce the power to 1/10 of its value, then what is going to happen is that instead of 90 degrees, you will only rotate 9 degrees. And if you only rotate 9 degrees, what you will get on the transfer plane here would be then significantly reduced. So that would be just, if I just reduce this by 9, then I'll get simply sine of 9 degrees here,
so
which
I'm
is
saying that if you have a larger dispersion, then you can actually transfer better. No.
All I'm saying is that if there is dispersion, then if you just apply your standard control, then you will not do well for all values of epsilon.
Oh.
But by engineering such a composite pulse or rotation, one is able to do well for all values of epsilon. So that over a magnitude of epsilon.
So are you going forward, or can we just stop there for a minute? Because it's not uniform, right? Really, it's certainly better than it was, but there's a variation of what percent.
Well, actually, you reduce the power from its nominal value. You calibrate a 90 degree power, and then you reduce the power to 1/10 of its value.
No, I understand that, but I'm just saying, is it go across? Say your maximum signal.
Yes. So it is
not 1 all the way.
Yes,
across.
Because it is actually exactly this phenomenon, which is that if I have a constant here and I approximate it by a Fourier series like this, then you see it at some points dips up, goes down, dips up, goes down.
I understand, but I'm just asking, what's the magnitude of those dips in that example you showed?
Well, you can take this, I mean, you can see that there is a dip, and you can now, you know, we just took 2-3 coefficients here of the Fourier series. If you take more coefficients, you can design actually a better Fourier series here such that you actually even minimize those dips. Everything boils down to then approximating things by a Fourier series, by how many coefficients you want to have.
And how does that affect the pulse?
Well, I mean, you know, if you take more coefficients, then your pulse becomes longer, and yes, but the point is that you can do this in a very analytical fashion.
How do you know the range of epsilon, like this delta that you specified?
Well, you can measure it, or you could say that I'm going to design a sequence that will work for an order of magnitude. Now, that's probably too much, but...
but in an approach, you could have something like 10% out of the gates or something like that, you would recover. So all spins, periods, so experimentally, you can easily find it.
So you cannot infront immediately your pulse length here?
Well, there will always be a minimum. If you have a certain value of epsilon, then doesn't... Okay, so there are two things here. One is, if you look at this construction here, there is no limiting time except for the strength of your RF field. If your RF field is completely unbounded, then the time it takes to produce this U1 and U2, these things, they can be shrinked down to zero. So if they can be shrinked down to zero, the pulse sequence can be shrinked down to zero. The limiting time here is the...
Do you have a kind of analytical relationship between time and...
Yes. And the analytical relationship is precisely this Fourier series. Every coefficient here, this coefficient is a small value. The time it is taking to produce this is k pi. And if the amplitude of what you apply is k pi over a, then that is the time it is taking to produce this term, actually more than this because it comes as a sum. But you can see a factor of that. And then you can add up all these times, and that's the relation.
Does it matter the order in which they're taking?
Yeah. I mean, everything is in the order because these things don't commute.
Right. But different beta k's?
Different beta k's? No, that doesn't matter. Of course, what you would like to do is actually then it would be kind of, you know, if you have a certain function 1 over epsilon, one can take such a Fourier series and say which component takes out the maximum energy for it. Or, you know, so it's projection onto the largest component, and we will try to synthesize that first. If the goal is to synthesize only few components, then you say which 1 over epsilon, what I didn't realize, what actually Stefan saw very first time, is that this thing actually looks like a cosine. So really, actually, this thing can be gets approximated by a cosine, and then it is so. Okay, so some negative results here that linear systems cannot be compensated for dispersion in epsilon, and the reason is simply just that the output depends. Is as a linear function in of the input, and therefore, you know, whatever value or modulation or things you put in U of t, the output here depends linearly on the input. You can never raise these powers of epsilon to higher powers. So
that's interesting, because that Bloch equation is linear. No.
No, Bloch's equation is...
Let me finish my point before you go to the third point. So we've had lots of success, right, in doing 90-degree, 180-degree pulse nonlinear. But now, okay, let's do short 20-degree, 10-degree, 30-degree pulses. It's like, oh, this is hard. This isn't as easy as we become used to seeing how easy it is because it's now linear.
Well, if you linearize it, and yes, and small flip angles, if you linearize it and try to do an analysis on the linear system, then that is going to tell you that you cannot do anything.
So we're wasting our time trying to get our
compensation for a linear system. Yeah.
I don't think that's true. The angles are too small, but you could use large flip angles in between that is compensated. So I'm not sure that's really it's not a linear system.
So as long as the
But at the same time, formally speaking, log equation is
block equation is a bilinear system. It is linear in individual components, but it is not true that if I was to write down an x dot equal to f of xu, where u are these control parameters, then you know it is not linear in both the controls and the state variables. So, you know, if I take a control pair x1 state pair u1 and another one which is x2 u2 and then do alpha plus beta and put it up there, so which it will then become alpha x1 plus beta x2 comma alpha u1 plus beta u2. Now this thing, if you put it in the block equations, this is not going to give you alpha f of x1 u1 plus beta f of x2 u2. So that is not true. But that is true for such a system, that this is linear in both x1, u1 pair. But block equations are bilinear, so if you were to fix this, so if it was also this thing, and only the one component was varying, then that is true. Then it is.
You can just see that the epsilon BU term, there's no x there. The term there, epsilon BU, there's no x there. If there were an x there, you would call that linear, but again, you would call it bilinear because then you have a product of x times u.
Also, you know, this is nilpotent systems cannot be compensated. So this is actually, if you linearize the block equation, you can actually put it into such a coordinate system where I have now these two can be thought of as these control fields. So when I switch on controls, my system evolves according to these vector fields. And now you can show that this system is controllable. But when I take the bracket of f and g, then it gives me a constant vector field. And then by taking further Lie brackets, I am not able to raise the power of epsilon. So actually one sees that although it's a nonlinear system, or in the way I talked about, it's a bilinear system, but still, because the defining Lie algebra is nilpotent, one is not able to raise the dispersion parameter to higher powers, and one loses this nice feature of ensemble controllability. So once, if you have a fixed value of epsilon, then the system is controllable, but you cannot engineer an input that will steer simultaneously all values of epsilon. So
this is a linearized version of the block equation?
Yes, actually you can linearize block equation on and that you will get. Okay, so actually one application of this Fourier synthesis method that I actually talked about could be is actually in in generating high resolution NMR spectra in homogeneous static fields. So the idea is that you have a sample placed in an inhomogeneous field, and as a result, the resonances or the chemical shifts of the various nuclei that one wants to see gets broadened out due to the inhomogeneous field, because at a spatial location R, the field that one sees is the static field and this inhomogeneous field delta Br. And therefore, if one pulses the sample and lets the magnetization persist, then in a given time capital T, the phase that magnetization or this persisting magnetic moment acquires is this genuine pure phase, which encodes for the chemical shift of the nuclei that one is interested in. But then one also encodes a spurious spatial phase, which depends on this inhomogeneity as a function of R. So at spin persisting at a spatial point R acquires in a time capital T a chemical shift encoding phase and a phase which is spurious or which leads to this broadening. And one is actually interested in finding out if it is possible to actually get an pure NMR information out of such a scenario by using radio frequency pulse sequences and gradient fields. And I like to argue that this is another kind of ensemble control problem. And the way one actually is able to do it is actually by engineering a time-varying gradient fields and a radio frequency field, which is able to produce rotations on this spin sample that is a desired function of space. And if one can synthesize a rotation like this as a desired function of spatial coordinate, then one can use this rotation that one has produced to actually cancel out this rotation that is produced by the spin spinning in this inhomogeneous field, and one can acquire this pure information. Now, how would one do that is, again, this kind of a Fourier synthesis technique method, whereby one actually can imagine that I have a sample like this, and I turn on a gradient field for a certain time that produces a rotation on the spin sample that depends linearly on space. Then I apply an RF pulse, which is a rotation around this generator. Then one turns on the gradient field and this RF pulse here, and then one applies again this thing. So it is exactly those six parameters that I talked in this Fourier synthesis method. And what one finds is that one is again able to, a leading order, produce a rotation that depends on the spatial coordinate as a cosine function of the spatial coordinate. So from a linear dependence here on the spatial coordinate by using this non-commuting property of these generators, one is able to actually produce a cosine dependence on the spatial coordinate. Now, theta k again is a design parameter, the flip angle of these pulses. So one, if I take product of such things, then one gets an exponential here, where these coordinates, theta k, can now be chosen that they actually approximate a desired phi of r. Phi of r is essentially a distribution of the inhomogeneous magnetic field. So if one is able to cancel its effect by actually design of these things, then one can actually acquire a pure spectrum. So a typical experiment then actually looks like applying such a sequence of gradients and radio frequency fields, which has the effect of actually canceling out or generating a spatial rotation like this. And then one lets the spins persist in this static magnetic field, which is inhomogeneous. And then the inhomogeneous part of the evolution, which was precisely this part here, is exactly canceled by this part that you have done using your RF pulses, and one is actually able to then get a pure spectrum. So it is actually a small demonstration of that, that one takes a sample with two closely placed resonances and puts it in artificially introduces an inhomogeneous field, and that actually broadens these lines, and that inhomogeneity is have this kind of a dependence here. And then by correcting them, or by producing arbitrary space-dependent rotations. So again, I have an ensemble of spins, and I am producing at different space points different rotations. I can cancel these things, and I am able to actually get back this was the reference, and then one is able to get back a pure spectrum by canceling the spatial inhomogeneity. And actually, you might wonder that this requires you to know a knowledge of this inhomogeneous field, but actually one doesn't. In fact, one can learn about a whole inhomogeneous field through this method. And the way it goes is that this pulse sequence which we designed, which had these gradients and pulse sequences, was producing for us a rotation on the sample that had a spatial dependence like this, where these theta k's were chosen such that the spatial dependence will exactly cancel the phase of due to inhomogeneous field. But suppose I am not able to cancel that, and I am able to produce a space-dependent phase which does not cancel this, then the difference in the two phases manifests itself as the broadening of your resonance. And therefore, actually, if you look at, all I have to do is adjust these parameters theta k such that this desired produced phase matches the unknown phase. But this is a minimization problem. It's actually a minimum, it's a mean square error problem. So I can actually think of just changing these phases theta k one by one, as such that I see actually a sharpening of these resonance lines, and then I can stop when I get the maxima that would have actually pinned down a value of theta k. Then I can go to a next value of theta k. And the whole point is that by a sequence of such things, one is able to pin down the exact value of phi gr, which means that one can actually learn about, one has learned and identified actually an inhomogeneous magnetic field. But again, as an ensemble control problem. So,
okay, so this is really very interesting. So what you're saying is that you have to make a sequence of measurements. But
yes.
Each time you keep adjusting this coefficient beta k,
yes,
in such a way that you maximize the signal, right?
Yes.
Then you learn about one coefficient, and then you go on to the next one.
Yes.
So, and this is assuming that your inhomogeneities don't change over time. Then.
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay, so coming back to the original problem of ensemble control, so that this I wanted to give as another example of ensemble control problem. So coming back to this original problem of ensemble controllability of block equations, so now if I have to generate if I want to actually I have dispersion in this delta omega, so I take to synthesize a bracket or raise this dispersion parameter omega to larger powers, I would need to produce a backward evolution like this. That would generate for me a commutator with respect to omega. And then by taking this as a building block, I can generate higher powers of omega or a desired function of omega. Now, producing this thing, a term like this, if your controls were unbounded, Coming back to your original question, if these controls were unbounded, then I can produce a term like this by actually nesting a forward evolution in between two pi pulses. So that would be actually...
I've lost your notation. What's omega compared to delta omega?
I'm sorry, so that's what I corrected for. This should be omega, or this should be delta omega. It's the same thing, yes, it is. So this is delta omega, yes. Now, if you have if you have very strong fields in your presence, then one can actually produce a backward evolution in no time by nesting a forward evolution in between a strong two pi pulses. And then, if one can do that, then one can produce a backward evolution, and one can go with the standard construction that I showed and produce a desired function of omega. But now, actually, if one doesn't have a strong pi pulse like this, even with a very weak pulse, one can actually produce a backward evolution like this. So that would be taking the drift in the backward direction. And that you can do by, well, there are a couple of ways one can do that. One is actually using what one would call an adiabatic passage, whereby adiabatic following, whereby one sweeps through all the resonances omega that one has in a system adiabatically, and one is able to invert a block vector that was originally oriented along North Pole down here with as weak controls as one has at one's disposal. And the effect is then one produces a rotation which is a desired function here of, which is a rotation. So if I look at this U, which has taken this block vector and inverted it, that can be decomposed as a pi rotation around X and these rotations here. But the effect is that U square is actually identity. So when I use this around this forward evolution, I am able to actually reverse this forward evolution.
So I just want to make sure I understand. Instead of the fields, if you have infinite field strength,
yes,
then you can produce the inverse direction as fast as you want.
Yes.
If you don't have infinite field strength, you can still produce the inverse direction, but the delta T now depends on each different member of the ensemble. Is that the problem?
No, there is no problem.
No. What I would ask is if you go back one slide. If you don't have infinite field strength, you can still produce the inverse direction. It's just that it takes a finite amount of time.
It takes, yes. So if you do not have infinite field strength, then you can still produce the negative direction, except that it is going to take you finite time.
Yeah, but the adiabatic passage method also takes finite time.
That is correct.
It even takes longer.
Yes, but you don't have to actually, if you see what I am trying to do, you don't have to produce an exact pi pulse. In a finite time, you can approximate a pi pulse. So if you actually look at, an adiabatic following, a hyperbolic secant pulse, the level of approximation that you want, if I want to come close to this inversion to a certain fidelity, I can do that in a time that will depend on that fidelity. But I can do that. I don't have to exactly come here. I can come to a certain approximate value of that. And what in the end will produce is actually then I can use this construction.
I'm still missing something. So it doesn't seem like the key point here is whether you have infinite power or finite power. The It's whether or not you want to exploit the robustness of the adiabatic passage method compared with high pulses.
No, you see this inversion business is only being used as a mechanism to produce rotation in the negative direction. Once I have that rotation in the negative direction, exactly if I have these full pi pulses or approximately with a certain fidelity that I can choose independently, then I will use this as a building block in my construction like this here to produce a desired polynomial of f of omega. And then if I have this desired polynomial of f of omega, I will say that I have actually ensemble controllability with respect to omega, that I can produce a desired rotation as a function of omega even if the strength of my control fields is as small as possible.
Yeah, but I still don't really understand the significance of having infinite fields. I think your point is, so basically if you have an infinite field strength, for all the resonance frequencies you can go from plus F to minus F. But as soon as it's not infinite anymore, then you have these, you don't have only transverse fields, but you have this finite Z components, corresponding to offsets, and then you never go down to the minus Z axis, but you rotate around some tilt axis, and you end up somewhere here. So it's this robustness issue, but it's not just the phase, it's also the integrator.
You see, this inversion, this motion that I want, if I have that at my disposal, then I can actually show ensemble controllability as a desired function of omega. Now, this you do not have for all omegas, unless you have infinite field strength, which will actually just do this inversion for all omegas. But the point is, actually by either this adiabatic following or well-known hyperbolic secant pulses, doesn't matter how weak that field is, one is able to actually invert this block vector that I have down here with arbitrary fidelity. And the time it takes depends on that fidelity. But I can choose that independently. And therefore, I can actually, once I invert that, the propagator that one produces, one can use that to actually invert this field.
But it'll take also, it'll depend on the weakness of the field, right? You said with arbitrary weakness of the field at some point.
Yes.
That'll affect the time.
Yes, the thing is, if you look at this construction here, there is f of omega, and f of omega is being approximated like a polynomial like this. So there are finite sequence of steps in this construction, and in those finite sequence of steps, so if I build a polynomial CK of omega, that approximates this function F of omega. Now there are finite number of steps that go into synthesizing this F of omega, in which there are finite number of such pi pulses. And if I actually go and approximate those with a desired independent level of fidelity, then I come arbitrarily close to this polynomial f of omega, and therefore I can approximate this thing to a desired level of accuracy.
I understand. I'm just questioning whether you can do it if the pulse gets arbitrarily weak in a finite time.
Well, you will, if you fix actually a pulse amplitude, then I can actually do that in a finite number of time. You know, it will change with...
I think I'm asking something too simple. A pulse amplitude for a hyperbolic secant pulse.
Yes.
Very, very arbitrarily close to zero. The maximum pulse amplitude.
Yes. Will be very large. Yeah. The duration would be very large.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you know, you will give me an amplitude. Still finite. See that? It's a construct. See. No.
I understood you said earlier that it was for, you had a fixed time.
No, I don't have fixed time at my disposal. If you give me an amplitude based on that, there will be a time T of A and epsilon, where epsilon, or let me use some other, say epsilon 1. This time will depend on this amplitude and the fidelity of this pi pulse that I want. So this will approximate this pi pulse to a desired level of fidelity, and it will depend on the amplitude. But whatever it is this fixed time T, and then I can actually go and implement these things and synthesize this polynomial. And the reason I am interested in this complicated constructions is that I wanted to show ensemble controllability of block equations. So this was an experiment done in group of Stefan Glaser, which was actually showing that here is on the x-axis is delta omega, and on the y-axis is epsilon, and one wants to engineer an input pulse that would excite spins with values lying there, delta, omega, and epsilon in this lighted picture, this figure. So when delta, omega, and epsilon lies in this, they all should execute a pi by 2 pulse. And when they lie outside, nothing should happen. It should be just, it should stay, the spins should stay along the longitudinal direction. So this was done using a numerical optimization, but one really finds good solutions that it does this, that one when applies it to this, that one sees no excitation outside in this. This actually motivates ensemble controllability, that I can produce a desired rotation as a function of omega and epsilon. And what I am trying to do is actually produce or construct sequence of pulses which are producing desired polynomials in omega and epsilon, which can then go and approximate such functions. Now, the thing is, it takes a much longer time, but then I showed you Fourier synthesis methods and so on, which actually cut down on this time and are actually quite useful. Okay, so few things. So how about ensemble controllability when U and V here are?
Sorry, can you go back for a second? You said that, just go back to the previous one. So the plots there are those are the results of a numerical calculation.
Yes.
So that wasn't using this method before?
No.
So it would be interesting to see what comes out of kind of pulses actually come out of the Fourier
synthesis method.
You expect it would be much simpler than that? Or just more robust?
I think the goal is to actually show constructive controllability. So first show controllability, that such a thing can be achieved, and then a constructive method which actually achieves that, which will help us kind of do a similar thing here, that I take a picture like this and I'm able to compute few Fourier coefficients. And based on those Fourier coefficients, I'm able to actually construct back the original pulse.
I mean, just to comment, so that I'm really in the group of Goldberg and Nielsen and Tom, I mean, we have used all these numerical tools, so we show in principle it's possible. But there was no theoretic understanding. Is it always possible? Were we just lucky? I mean, probably we have been very fortunate. So that what Amin shows is really a constructive way to that you can do this, you can show limits. There is no claim at all that this is time optimal. I mean, I still think probably if you do it numerically, you get shorter pulses. You this, I mean, to do it in realistic settings. But it shows, I mean, in some cases, it may be even short enough. And the nice thing is you don't need to optimize, you just have to.
I think you have analytical constructions that.
It might be interesting to see what these pulses are doing on the blocks here to the ensembles. I mean, how do you look at that? looked at that? I guess you
should.
I mean, we did experiments with these pulses, but we haven't actually, I mean, you can calculate much of that. I think it does look very complicated, but that's a very clean way to look at that.
I mean, in principle, it must be using, let's say, the omega y over and over in order to be able to get, you know, it must be ultimately based on a mechanism similar to the one that we described, that you have multiple contributions, let's say, to omega y in order to compensate.
Yeah, I mean, you see what we made
that looks like an encryption algorithm.
But it might actually be interesting if you go to those pulses, you could perhaps invert out of those pulses, you know, all the contributions to see exactly what the series is, let's say omega x, omega y, omega z.
But
I
think it's very difficult to do that and get useful ways down. But obviously he's finding this x, y, will have a different trajectory with the black ones and in certain point of the sphere and the white ones and the another point of the sphere. So I think that would be very, very complicated. We try sometimes to look at patterns that it's difficult.
And obviously the same principles must be there in a way, but it's not as clear as construction. I mean, it's just some way to do the same thing, but it doesn't realize all the multiple concatenated.
If delta omega actually are arising due to gradients that you can switch on and off, so delta omega can be inverted, then the same Fourier synthesis actually method works. You can take this and just do a Fourier decomposition in epsilon and delta omega space and then get an analytical solution. The real, actually, at the heart of all this is when the drift is flowing of its own and it is an infinite dimensional system and you have limited use, then those constructions become easy. And I if you say, give me a construction that would produce this JMR today, I don't have it. Maybe by evening I'll try. I don't know.
What happens if you add the relaxation?
If you add relaxation,
stable, is it robust with respect to just minus k selector?
Well, if you have relaxation, then the more time you take, the more you go inside the Bloch sphere.
Yes.
So it won't be, you will lose anyway.
Will it destabilize the trajectory and get it elsewhere, or will it simply fade in amplitude?
I see. Well, I think it'll depend on the actual motion the spins make, because it is not just a motion along a great circle that you just then shrink inside. It's a more complicated motion. So,
I think it would be the case that if you just fuse inside, if T1 times
or T2 times, so in fast motion regime with isotropic liquids, you'll probably be the robust with
respect to larger molecules.
But even then, people have no quite to what they do. So if it was connected to zero, then it would be. Oh, I see. Oh.
So
there's probably a limit to the time spans that you can have for those pulses.
Yes. I mean, that's anyway, the shorter you can do, it's better. Actually, so I wanted to just describe some other ensemble control problems. One is ensemble controllability of switched systems. So I talked about this system in which I said, you know, that one can actually compensate for dispersion in epsilon. In fact, one can do it to arbitrary level as a desired function of epsilon. But what if these U's and V's are actually, instead of taking positive and negative values, they are constrained to lie only positive? So you can switch on these U and V's, and that's all you can. So you cannot make these negative. So that would be, I switch on this control and I have this generator here, and I switch on this control and I have this generator. But I cannot make them negative, then does one have ensemble controllability for such a system? And actually, it turns out that it's not very different from what we talked about before. I can fix these values of u and v to a positive large value a, and then just modulate this component v, something like this, whose frequency of modulation here is the same as this thing here. Then once you go into a frame of rotation around this generator here, rotating at angular frequency a, then one demodulates this component down to a slowly varying phase phi of t, and this b, which is much smaller than a, and one gets a system like this here, and this delta a here generator becomes kind of a Larmor dispersion that we were talking about. So you have delta pulling out in a Larmor dispersion term, and this whole thing epsilon bringing out in an RF dispersion term. And the goal is then to modulate B and phi, and such that one actually has an ensemble controllability over delta and this dispersion. But actually what I just talked about, this thing is ensemble controllable, and therefore this original switched system is also ensemble controllable. And actually there's a nice application of ensemble control for such switched systems, which arises from actually dynamics of coupled electron nuclear spin systems at low magnetic fields. If one looks at the Hamiltonian of such a system, that is the Zeeman precision of the electron spin, nuclear spin, and the hyperfine coupling tensor. Now, this is the largest term here that sets the quantization axis for the electron spin, and that is the nuclear spin Zeeman. And if these two terms here at low fields, when the Zeeman frequency of the nuclear spin is comparable to actually the hyperfine coupling tensor term, then one gets a secular term like this here. The point being that if one looks at the nuclear spin, then the nuclear spin sees a field due to the electron spin tensor, the coupling due to the electron spin, and the static field. And that field points in a certain direction, d alpha, when the electron spin is oriented along the magnetic field, and the opposite direction when the electron spin is oriented against the magnetic field. So one can actually now, the nuclear spin, depending on the orientation of the electron spin, sees two different quantization axes. And this, the strength of these fields is actually is of this order of this hyperfine coupling tensor, which can be in megahertz range. So this actually suggests a wonderful mechanism for actually producing rotations on the nuclear spin by simply toggling the state of the electron spin. So by flipping the electron spin up and down, one produces two different directions of motion or rotations for the nuclear spin, so that if I was to actually just invert the state of or invert the nuclear spin, there is this direct transition here. By putting an RF, I can do that, but that's limited by the strength of the RF field. Or one can follow a motion like this suggested here, whereby I flip the electron spin and go to the upper manifold, in which very much like this things that David has talked about, there's a molecular wave packet that evolves in the upper level. So here when I go up, I have a net field that is seen by the nuclear spin, and you nutate around that. And then if I put a pi pulse again, then I start rotating around a different axis. And these rotations or these precisions are happening at the strength of this hyperfine coupling, which is in the megahertz. So this is a mechanism for fast rotations of these things. And this is actually a switched system that people have considered back in controls, whereby there are two different directions of rotations, and I can actually just toggle between the two fast enough and produce a desired rotation. The challenge to ensemble controllability comes that if these two directions, d alpha and d beta in a powder, are not predefined exactly, in fact, there is a dispersion in the values of d alpha, and there is a dispersion in the values of d beta, the orientations, and also the precision around these omega alphas and omega betas. So then one asks the question, is the system ensemble controllable? Does there exist a sequence of switching times that would do arbitrarily well for all values of d alpha and d beta? And this was a model problem that we set out to look at, whereby these U's and V's can only be positive. So this would be, if this electron is pointing up, then the nuclear spin is nutating around this at a certain velocity. So you turn on a certain generator of motion, and then you switch that back, and it is mutating around this at a certain velocity, angular velocity, and but you cannot reverse the rotation. So does there exist a switching time such that I'll be able to produce a motion on this block sphere at irrespective or immune to this parameter here, which is epsilon? So what I showed was that this system is ensemble controllable. Now, if these omega A's and omega B's are not oriented perpendicular to each other, but make an angle, one can make a similar argument, and one gets ensemble controllability for such systems. I wanted to talk about problems of ensemble control in solid-state NMR. So this is problems involving control of spin dynamics or transfer of coherence in solid-state NMR systems, where there's a big dispersion in the coupling strength. And what one can do? What's the time?
It's 15 more minutes.
Okay. So a typical problem here is actually described here, in which again X is a block vector evolving on this block sphere here, and U's are your input controls. And beta, this term here is your drift. So this is the drift. And this drift has a strength beta that has a dispersion in it. Furthermore, the drift is periodic, and therefore it's varying with time. And this angle gamma, the phase of this periodic motion, has also a dispersion. So a typical problem is I want to engineer these excitations u of t that will start with this initial pointing up, and it is able to invert this and be immune to values of omega and gamma and this input excitation epsilon. So motivation for this is coming from solid state NMR, whereby when one is interested in looking at the chemical shifts of a given spin I, and get this chemical shift information, but the spin I then sees other interactions due to neighboring spins, and due to shielding, due to the electronic environment, and all these other interactions are anisotropic, and they depend on, say, for instance, this interaction with the other spin depends on the angle of this intranuclear vector with respect to this static field, and depending on different values of theta, this interaction, this field that one, the spin sees, has this theta dependence on it. So instead of seeing well-resolved peaks that would only arise due to an isotropic chemical shift of this spin, one sees this anisotropic electronic and this other spin interactions, which takes these lines and broaden them, because there are all these values of delta b as a function of theta here. So these frequencies all get broadened, so one gets a poorly resolved spectra. In liquids, this problem doesn't arise because delta b fluctuates with time, because this theta changes with time as the molecule tumbles, and these delta b's gets averaged out. But in this case, they are there, so to get actually well-resolved information here, one would like to average them artificially, and one does that by actually spinning your sample around a certain axis. So if one looks at the form of these interactions, say this spin I seeing interaction due to a neighboring spin S has an orientation dependence which goes something like this, and depending on different values of theta, this strength would be different, and that leads to this broadening. Now, if one modulates this theta by spinning this sample around a certain axis, then one actually takes this and averages this to zero. So at a value of theta, which is 54.7, this value is zero. So one takes this theta and spins around 54. So theta half of the time is less than this, half of the time more than that. And therefore, such interactions get averaged out. And one starts with a broad line that get narrower by this magic angle spinning. But that is the source of periodic drifts in NMR systems, so for such systems. So one has an interaction term which is being modulated due to spatial spinning of this sample like this here. And now this is being done to actually get well-resolved lines to remove all anisotropic interactions that a given spin is seeing. But at some points, we would like this interaction to be present there, because one would like to measure distances between the spins. And in high-resolution NMR experiments, one would like to transfer coherence from one spin onto another. So one would like this interaction to be switched off on again. And you do that by observing that if this rotor, this spinning was being done at frequency omega r, then this modulating term in front of the coupling tensor has Fourier components at cosine omega r and cosine 2 omega r. So now if I actually, so I have a coupling between the spins which is being modulated at frequency omega r and 2 omega r. Now, if I go and actually put an RF field here, and this RF field is such that it nutates or rotates the two spins differentially, such that the difference in the Rabi frequencies of these spins I and S is precisely this omega r, then I will be modulating this coupling tensor again by another omega r that will generate a secular term with this rotation which is already there, or a static term with this rotation which is already there due to this spatial spinning, and one will be able to recouple these spins. So that's the basic idea. And now one can do all this analysis. So SU4 has been talked about a lot in this week and before, and so there are these two sub-SU2 or SO3 sub-algebras of SU4. That play a part actually in understanding this recoupling. So if I take my natural coupling Hamiltonian here and I can break it into these two coupling Hamiltonians, this constitutes a part of this SO3 algebra, the zero quantum frame, and this constitutes this part of the SO3 algebra, the double quantum frame. And now if I bring in an RF field such that the strength of the Rabi frequencies of the two spins is precisely equal to omega r at which the rotor was spinning, then this term here, which is the RF field, will act on this part of this Hamiltonian here and rotate it at omega r, which then with this term beats against this term to produce a static term. And that's really how this bilinear control system comes in. So you have this term here that we are calling as omega z being modulated at cosine omega r, and an RF term which rotates the two spins, then the Rabi frequency, the difference is precisely equal to omega r. So if I set up this system just confined to this SO3 algebra here, that or SU2 algebra here I talked about, then you get the system on the Bloch sphere. So this is representing this interaction term, so-called the zero quantum frame, and then you have this modulation, and you bring in now the difference of the two Rabi frequencies is this omega r. Now if one goes into this interaction frame of this, then you rotate this term here to a static term like this. And this thing is going to take your original operator x and invert it in this zero quantum frame, which boils down to transfer of coherence from one spin onto another. Two things to note, this rotation axis depends on the phase gamma of n, so for, but it works well for all values of gamma. So this actually, this works for all values of gamma. So this system here is going to work for, if I just put in an strength omega r, it is going to work for all values of gamma here. But this transfer here is then dependent on this strength of the coupling between the spins. So depends on this beta. So then the challenge is, can I modulate this term and do this transfer and make it immune to beta and still work for all values of gamma? So this is set of very interesting problems. Now, if the strength of what you apply is actually has an RF inhomogeneity, then one sees that instead of rotating around a transfer axis, one actually rotates around a tilted axis, and this transfer is not complete. So it is genuinely, again, a problem of control of ensembles, where dispersion in the RF field, the strength of the couplings between the nuclei, and the phase of precision of a crystallite around this rotor axis, all of these actually play a part, and one has to design things so that one is immune to all of these things. So one can do interesting design and techniques for doing that. So one irradiates the system at omega r, which produces a secular term, but there is an inhomogeneity here. One does that for a rotor period, in which one takes this term and demodulates this to a static term. But then one switches the phase of this or makes that negative, and one produces actually a secular, a static term like this, except this dispersion here becomes negative. And then one actually looks at the joint sum, then one finds that one get to leading order gets rid of this RF inhomogeneity. Well, you can think of this as going between plus minus, yes, changing the phase bang, but it's not exact. It's more specific actually to this problem, yeah. So one can then actually design a sequence of pulses such that they are also immune to this gamma and this epsilon parameters. So I'll actually skip along. So there are some results on actually this is a conventional experiment which is very sensitive to RF inhomogeneity, and then by this phase alternation one can make it more robust, but it depends on angle gamma, and then by actually introducing playing tricks by sequences like this with the rotor and things, one can actually make it more robust too. Or gamma. So I think this is too short a time to explain this, but it also brings it down to some these problems. Again, this periodic system with periodic drift, and you have your controls, this omega r, which you use to actually demodulate this drift. But on top of that, you can modulate this thing further. And then one can design actually interesting recoupling sequences, which recouples these spin Hamiltonians. And these resemble these composite pulses. And so that's something we have done. And one can then try to do some optimization on top of it, this here, and actually get, so these are interesting composite pulses one gets. I think I'll stop because at this point I'm making less sense.
The Higgs, delta omega, you have the Higgs field limitation, you have some, so you can construct pulse with given legs. Yeah? Is it shows somehow that somebody can construct pulse by using other way with different times, 10% less or 10 times less, or you have no idea how it was. I mean, you have no idea if there is a possibility to construct much shorter pulse.
Okay, so yes, so you know, the only, actually, so this boils down to, this comes to actually optimal control of ensembles. And you, numerical optimizations have been successful in demonstrating that there are shorter pulses and things like that. In my knowledge, there is one problem that has been analytically solved of optimal control of an ensemble. And actually, I had a slide on that. That's not my solution. That's very well known in literature. And that is, again, this problem here, X, Y, Z, and a dispersion in delta omega, and I want to steer this system from the starting point and bring it down to the equator, and in the process, I want to minimize a sum like this. Now, this thing here create an excitation profile as a value of delta omega, minimizing u square plus v square. Now, that is the classical well-known SLR algorithm. Actually, if you do this, it boils down to a problem of filter design, but it does give time-efficient pulse sequences. So that, in my mind, so this is also actually constructing polynomials in a very different way, but this actually gives, one can show that this actually minimizes the energy of the pulse.
But your method doesn't...
It doesn't minimize the energy of the pulse.
And even you have no idea how it's far from minimum.
No, the Fourier synthesis method that I showed doesn't, it is a constructive method which is, you know, I was saying to everybody that every parent thinks that his child is most beautiful, so.
So the conclusion that for linear system, which means for very small angle, you cannot do it. It means that I also will not be able.
For linear system, you cannot. Yes.
It's a different thing. I mean, you can. I mean, apparently, you can create small angle pulses because our system is not linear,
yeah.
And just the final pulse angle is small. But actually, as Navin has shown, you can produce with the Fourier synthesis, and you can use one bilinear system, you can create any theta of epsilon. And with theta, I mean, in this example, it was 90 degrees or 180. With theta, is 10 degrees or 5 degrees. We can also produce.
I mean, we can construct a
sequence that doesn't.
It's not difficult. All I said is linear system. If you just work with a linear system, you cannot compensate it for dispersion in the input control. But the block equations are not linear. They are bilinear. So you will have to go away from the starting point, but then you can come back.
So even for, this means that for even for small angle, you could, and so do I, construct pulse which will tolerate any
error. Any error, yes. Even for small angle, yes.
And last question. All of this, it's related for pulse, doesn't matter if it's broadband pulse or not broadband pulse. It's this theory for any pulses, yeah? Like Shinar-Larou.
Yes. The Shinar-Larou is a constructive algorithm.
Yeah, I know, but all this methodology and
yes.
construction method.
Yes.
Only you can apply only for broadband pulses or for selective pulses.
The construction of Fourier synthesis that I showed is for just RF inhomogeneity and for doing NMR spectroscopy in inhomogeneous fields. I didn't show you a design method for broadband pulses as well as RF inhomogeneity.
Yeah, but you can do it.
I showed you a construction that it can be done, but I didn't. I gave you a construction which shows that it can be done. I haven't given you an efficient way of doing that. Well, it says it can be done, so then if it can be done, then there has to be an efficient way of doing it.
But did you show that they can be done simultaneously? You didn't give instruction.
Yeah, no. So if you actually... I gave a controllability proof that it can be done. But I didn't give a Fourier synthesis method for doing it.
But this is for, this one now is for the Larmor distribution that you've got. No, and that's for the nominal ideal RF field.
Yeah, and if you have both delta, omega, and epsilon, then you get joint polynomials like this, and you can control each of these terms independently. Yes. The construction works for this. It is whether you have an efficient technique for doing both of them.
And also somewhere in there, it should show up. What we see is you got to trade one for the other, right? If you want larger Larmor dispersion, you generally would seem you have to sacrifice the RF tolerance or vice versa. You can get arbitrary large Larmor dispersions and arbitrary large RF tolerance.
Well, that would, if you want to get arbitrary large, then that would mean generating these higher terms. So that would then show up in your construction.
So you'll have that finished this afternoon?
Well, actually, this Fourier synthesis method for both of this, if delta omega can be inverted, there's a gradient that can be plus and minus. If there, then there is a very clean way of doing it, and we have that. So that's. But in presence of a Larmor dispersion where you cannot invert this, it's slightly more tricky. Yeah.
So late afternoon.
Well, we'll see.
There was this early work by what's his name, Malcolm Levitt, that was also designed to kind of compensate for homogeneity in terms of some directions on the blocks here.
Yes.
Is there some way that you can interpret what you did using this methodology? And the second part of that question is.
If I try to distinguish that work slightly from this, I'm really trying to come up with a methodology that helps me design things of desired functions of these parameters. And also for omegas. So for omegas, there is already actually, if you just want to, you know, SLR algorithm actually. If you go there. SLR algorithm actually does that. It is able to generate polynomials as a function of this dispersion.
SLR,
no, this is a Sheena L. Rao algorithm. It is able to do that as a function of this that delta omega. So this. I don't know, in my knowledge, I don't think there is one which works both for delta omega and a nice constructive control, like an efficient way of actually constructing for both delta omega and epsilon. So that if you take this pattern pulse, you can do some kind of an analytical construction of a pulse.
Oh, by the way, Shana Maruch cannot tolerate any F, even don't consider
That's what I'm saying. There is no inhomogeneity. I think I'll stop.